This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. The opening last January of the Beckler Museum of Modern Art was a landmark event for art lovers in particular and for Charlotte at large. The moment they opened the doors, the Beckler became one of the most important art museums in the region, thanks to the generosity of the man whose name is on the door.
Well, I'm a kind of private person, and spotlight is not where I'm thriving so much.
That's longtime Charlottean Andreas Beckler, who donated his family's $60 million collection of modern art to the city. He may be private, but now his family's collection of art, created by some of the most important artists of the 20th century and collected over the course of 70 years, is anything but.
When my parents married, they lived in an apartment in Switzerland, and as business-wise, my dad got very successful. They decorated their home. You know, that was the first, you know, order of the day was, let's put something on our walls. We have nothing. This is the wealth that you see here. We are not the Rockefellers, but we have wonderful pieces of art.
When you see the collection, it's difficult to imagine growing up in a home filled with works by people like Picasso, Calder, Miro, and Warhol, but that's what life was like for Andreas Beckler, and his attitude about transferring ownership of these family heirlooms, these masterpieces, is startlingly generous.
Of course, it's like children, you know, they are fabulous for you, but they don't belong to you, and you let them go.
Today, a conversation about the collection and what it means to art lovers and to Charlotte, and about the museum in which the collection is housed, which is itself a work of art and one that has added immeasurably to the architectural fabric of our city. We're joined for the hour by the president and CEO of the Beckler Museum, John Boyer. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Nice to have you with us. You have a background with museums, the Mark Twain House in Hartford, Connecticut, teaching history of modern art at a college, Trinity College, and architecture at Trinity College, also in Connecticut, and in running a public policy institute. And you've also worked in the financial industry with the Aetna Financial Services Mutual Funds and ING Funds, among other things. How do you explain this this wide-ranging set of interests and talents? It's all over the place. It's left brain, right brain.
I don't know how to answer that question right now. Although you're right, there is, I suppose, I'd like to think, I suppose there's some left and right at work simultaneously. I've just been lucky. Lots of wonderful opportunities surfaced, and clearly this is the best so far.
The doors to the Beckler opened in January, as I said, but the planning and preparation for that museum has been going on literally for years. How did they find you, and at what point in the process did you join the museum?
Well, I was found through a search firm who had been contracted by the leadership of the board, and I was in Connecticut at that time and working in New York. And I was particularly attracted to this opportunity because I just love the notion of institution building. And so to your question, the larger agreement that binds the Beckler Collection with the city and the efforts of the Arts and Science Council and then Wachovia as the developer for this extraordinary project, that master agreement was signed back in September of 2006.
Okay.
I did not start. I accepted the position in January of 08 and started on March 1st of 08. And frankly, by then, Mario Botta's splendid museum building was a colossal hole in the ground already there on South Tryon Street with the framing just then emerging from the earth. So I didn't have the chance to be part of the design process for the building itself, which, of course, I regret all the time. That's such an exciting period in the development of any museum building. But when I did come on board, I inherited two wonderful people who were working out at Little Italy, a place where Andreas at that time was keeping much of the collection, Michael Godfrey, who served as our curator, and Teddy Boss as our registrar. But beyond that, there was no org chart, no other staff. The board at that point was made up of about six people, and now we're fully formed at 21 with the ability to go to 25. And so there's been an awful lot of work advanced in the last 2 years by many people, not the least of whom, of course, is Andreas himself.
Why is it here? Why is Andreas here? And why is this collection of art here?
Well, that's certainly, I'm glad you asked that early on because it's the question that we hear most often. Andreas came to Charlotte in the early 70s to take a look at a particular business entity on behalf of his family's interests in Zurich. you know, the company that his father and his uncle formed starting in the late 1930s, one of their many areas of specialty was maintaining the environments of manufacturing settings. And with North Carolina being one of the great seats, perhaps the great seat of the textile industry in this country, and with textile environment, manufacturing environment being particularly vexing for both machines and for the employees. This is one of the things that Andreas came to investigate for the family. He was here for about 18 months, had done all of his due diligence, and then went back to Zurich as had been planned. But as he will tell you, he was infected with the spirit of optimism, of openness, of candor, and frankly of artistic promise that he saw in the United States during his time here in Charlotte. And I think it's safe to say after much back and forth with his father and with the business, he did come back very soon afterwards and ran Numafil, which was the company that the family was interested in. And Andreas ran that for, I'd say, about 20 years or so, finally retiring around the mid-90s. So by that time, his roots were so deeply set here in North Carolina. And two of his three daughters were born, and all three were raised here. And this is where all of his closest friends were, apart from those from his youth, who, in fact, he remains very close with folks from Switzerland and elsewhere. So he just loves the city and loves it so much, of course, he gave an extraordinary gift to Charlotte.
And here's, but here's a fellow who grew up in a family that collected art early on, and we'll talk about how that collection came to be, but these were not initially massively wealthy people. They just collected art over a long period of time from some very good artists over a long period of time. Is that possible? And he himself became an art collector at a young age and an artist at a young age. How is it he came to be comfortable in North Carolina that is not necessarily a place that has created a lot of Salvador Dalis and people like that? It just hasn't.
That's a good question, too.
I wish he were here, but he turned us down.
No, I mean, I heard from the clips that you had run earlier, that is just so purely Andreas. He's an exceptionally private person, despite the public aspect of this generous act of his and his family's. I think it's really about promise and opportunity. When he came to Charlotte, it didn't have to be Zurich. Zurich wasn't always Zurich, frankly. No matter what you might think about great European cities, they too have gone through endless transformations over the centuries. And one of the most seductive things to so many Europeans and Asians and others who elect to settle here in our country, and we all know this, so it's a commonplace, I apologize, is what remarkable opportunity there is here for you in business, in the arts, just in your engagement, frankly, with the natural world, a sense of scale and space and freedom. All of those things were exceptionally attractive to Andreas, as they are to hundreds of thousands of people every year.
All of those are artistic terms, by the way. Seriously, a sense of space, freedom, it just seems to be an artist's set of vocabulary.
Well, I think it's a good point, and I would argue that you can stretch that lexicon very broadly and still feel comfortable in an artistic space. And I think that that is emblematic of the way that Andreas sees the world of art as well. That is to say, art at its best will be somehow perfectly interwoven into everything that you do. The workspace, what you do for recreation, what you do for the most vigorous intellectual engagement, the way you express your affection for others, where you take chances, where you find solace and comfort and redemption. I think he would argue, as I would and many in our field would, that art is not only reserved for those moments on a Saturday afternoon when you feel like you've got to take visiting relatives someplace, although it is that, and we want people to do that.
Yep.
It's meant to be woven entirely into your life every day. And so you've got this young couple, Andreas's parents, without much wherewithal, making an early decision to make sure that their children were raised with wonderful objects in front of them, not just some of the time, but all of the time. And that's what really was the spark.
But a lot of people have that sensibility. Maybe not a lot, maybe not enough. But there are people out there who have that sensibility and begin to collect art. But they don't collect Warhol, and they don't collect Miró and Calder. I mean, at the time that the Becklers, the senior Becklers, were collecting these artists, were these artists the artists they have become, or were they lesser-known, affordable artists?
Well, that's very much the key for many of the artists represented in the collection, and also, I think, an important element of what separates the collection from so many other wonderful holdings, institutional and private. You're right. Alberto Giacometti was not the Giacometti we heard of 2 months ago when a single sculpture by him was sold at Christie's in London for $104 million. Mm-hmm. This was not the Giacometti that Hans and Bessie and Andreas as a young boy got to know. Okay. This was Giacometti still struggling to find his place as an artist and, frankly, within the gallery arena. Hans, in particular, became very close with Andreas, with Alberto, and in fact became the founding president of the Giacometti Foundation in Switzerland, and Hans served in that capacity for 27 years. So that's a testament not only to his early relationship with Giacometti before he became a major figure internationally and powerfully influential in the world of modern art, but also Hans's commitment and the longevity of his devotion to that particular institution which he helped found. And I think that both of those things, a sense of prescience, finding artists before they make it big, and then even whether they make it big or not, that sense of loyalty and devotion to an artist, those are elements that Andreas has learned as well.
But it seems to me also to be a testament to the Bechtler's eye for art. It's easy to say, okay, at this stage, it's easy to say, since I can afford it, I'll buy an Andy Warhol, or I'll buy... who did I mention here? A Picasso.
Sure.
Well, Picasso's Picasso. But when he wasn't Picasso, it's another thing to say, that's an interesting piece. That has artistic value. I want that in my home.
Well, you're right. It's a matter of having a great eye. It's a matter of spending time with artists. Remember, so much of the collection is a result of their personal friendship with these artists and with other collectors. And sometimes with institutions like the great Kunsthaus in Zurich, where both Andreas's father and Andreas's uncle were deeply involved in the board and the acquisitions committee and made a huge commitment and contribution to that organization as well. So all of those different kinds of relationships are important learning opportunities. You know, I'm not going to argue here this morning whether or not Hans somehow natively, constitutionally, had a wonderfully prescient eye as a collector. I don't know that that was the case. But what I do know was that after you dedicate yourself to understanding art and knowing artists and taking chances every so often when you do elect to acquire something, ultimately, if you're consistent and you remain committed, you're going to build a wonderful collection for you. Now, remember, it's also a matter of acquiring what you love and what you want to live with, and that these pieces have stories that are personal for you. All of that, I think, makes for a great strength in this collection. Yes, as it turns out, it was Sandy Calder, and it was Alberto Giacometti, and it was Juan Miró, and all these extraordinary figures. So that's just our good luck here in Charlotte, too.
And the personal nature, the personal relationship that the Bechtlers had with the artists and with these works of art are really well pointed out. As you tour the museum, particularly if you tour it with the audio tour, which you're the voice of, as a matter of fact.
It was a cost savings, Mike.
It's a good idea. You're wonderful at it, by the way. I mean, you really are.
Thanks.
I was very surprised when I heard your name come up at the very beginning, and here I am, the president and CEO. I'm going to take you to the museum. I thought, oh, my God. But no, it's wonderful. It truly is wonderful. John Boyer is our guest, president and CEO of the Bechtler Museum of Art, Modern Art. We will continue our conversation in just a moment. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Charlotte Talks is made possible in part today by Volvo of Charlotte on Independence Boulevard and the S80 sedan with 6-speed automatic transmission, electronic traction control, and available with V6, V8, or turbo. VolvoCharlotte.com. We hear a lot about the challenges of teaching, and particularly teaching in urban public schools, but there are also rewards about which we hear almost nothing. Well, a recently produced documentary, Souls of Our Teachers, examines the challenges, frustrations, and rewards faced by teachers in Charlotte's urban schools, and we meet two of those teachers and find out what motivates them to work in troubled situations, and we'll talk about the good and the bad and the inspiring tomorrow morning at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, New UN Security Council sanctions on Iran over its nuclear program further inflame tensions between Tehran and other nations. Iran's relationship with the world and its internal conflicts 1 year after disputed presidential elections.
That's the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon on 90.7 FM WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Our guest today is John Boyer, the president and CEO of the Beckler Museum of Modern Art, which opened on South Tryon Street on the Wells Fargo Cultural Campus back in January and has become, as I said at some point in the beginning of the show, the minute the doors opened, it became one of the most important museums in the Southeast and certainly one of the most important museums here, next to its neighbor, which will open in October, the Mint Museum. I'm sorry, they're going to be fighting you for bragging rights, I suppose, because they have a new building as well. How many pieces in the Beckler collection that's going to be housed in that museum? Because this, I understand, is only a portion of the Beckler family's collection, the portion that Andreas Beckler inherited. How many pieces in this collection?
Well, the sort of the combined holdings that Andreas had received from his parents and also pieces that Andreas himself had acquired over the years, total around 1,400. And right now, when you visit the museum, we have around 115 on display.
So 10% at any given time.
10% at any given time, yeah. And that will not always be the case because of scale issues. Some pieces are very large, some pieces are small. But I'd say on average in any given moment, you shouldn't expect to see more than 10% of the collection.
How often will you be rotating the collection?
Well, we made a decision early on recognizing that this is the birth of an entirely new institution, not the advancement of a new gallery space for an existing institution. And so we knew from the beginning there was an awful lot of interest, frankly, internationally, for what actually was in the collection and how were we going to present it. So we elected to keep this initial installation up for an unusually long time. We opened in January, and we won't change for our first exhibition until the middle of this upcoming September. However, having said that, during this first window, we will be swapping out pieces periodically. We have done that, and we'll continue to do that, so you're never really quite sure exactly what's going to be on the walls when you come. Starting in September, though, we'll begin changing out three different shows a year. In the fall, we'll begin with the School of Paris, and then we're working on shows on Saul LeWitt and Nicky de Saint-Phalle, who, of course, is the sculptor who did the great Firebird outside of the museum.
That strikes me as a very brave thing to do, to put that sculpture outside of the museum. I'm serious.
Well, I hate to ask you questions, but tell me, why do you think it would be brave? Because I'll tell you the answer, which is a very good one, but I want to know.
Because usually in most institutions of art, particularly with sculpture and painting, you don't want people to touch it because they leave their fingerprints on it. This is a glass mirrored sculpture, sculpture, and it seems to me that it could easily break it, deliberately break it. Things could happen to it. It's out there. You can get right up next to it, take your picture in the middle of the archway. I mean,
sure.
So does that not concern you?
Well, yes and no. It's the most reasonable question that we should ask as stewards for the object to make sure that it remains in perfect condition and safe forever. I mean, it's there for the duration. Like, it is literally welded to the steel plates that are built into that floor surface. So the Firebird is going to be there to celebrate Charlotte and all of its artistic energy for generations to come. And we do, of course, keep very close watch over the piece, but I'll tell you what I think happens. I think what happens is that great communities find all kinds of ways to rise to the occasion. We went back and forth as a board, all of the board leadership involved with the new building committee, as it was referred to, and when we were talking about the Firebird, we did discuss all different kinds of mechanisms to keep people, A, from walking up to it, B, being able to bring their bicycles or whatever up to it, or their skateboards, whatever it ends up being. In the end, we decided to trust the community as fully as we could, and I think that we've been rewarded exceptionally. And I'll just give you two quick stories. The first is, in the span of a single day, I looked down from my office window and I could see a group of, this is probably in, I don't know, late January, group of little 6 to 8 year olds, you know, all stuffed into their jackets with a couple of adult teachers, and the kids are kind of swarming around the piece. And finally, two of them spontaneously and simultaneously reach out and hug the sculpture and bring the little faces up to the mirrors. Now, I'd like to think they were kissing the sculpture, but more than likely they were looking at their faces all fragmented and goofy. Mm-hmm. But it's just perfect, right? Later that same day, I'm told by a staff member that a guy on a huge motorcycle going south on Tryon jumped the curb, brought his bike underneath the branch, like underneath, they look like legs, but underneath the branch of the sculpture, parked his bike, got off, took a few steps back, pulled out his cell phone to take a photograph of the object of his desire, his motorcycle, with the Firebird. So instantly you see the breadth of spectrum of all different kinds of people, all the wedding shots, all of the veterans there after the Veterans Day parade, all of these folks who just instantly fall in love with this joyful, wonderful piece of art. This is exactly what Andreas wanted to have happen right when the Firebird was placed, and we couldn't be happier.
Well, good. How would you, because you've taught modern art at the college, how would you describe this collection of art in terms of how it represents the modern art of the mid-20th century? Put it into some sort of perspective.
Sure. It's if you had to do a quick analysis of the what's the midpoint chronologically, it's around 1957-58. Mm-hmm. And its greatest strengths reach to the late 20s and up through the, let's just say, the early 80s. And so that's really what we're talking about. The vast majority of the 1,400 pieces clearly are European, French, Swiss, German, Italian. There is a large contingent of American art represented, and there's a strong contingent of British art represented as well. Mm-hmm. And then there are the occasional and very important outliers, Russian, Hungarian, and a few others. But geographically, it's primarily European with a wonderful sense of some American and some British. It's not meant to be encyclopedic. It's not all artists of all stripes and all movements and all periods and all great centers of art. It's more idiosyncratic in that it reflects the particular interests of the family over the years. But their tastes were broad, as we've already touched on. This is a large collection, and a lot of different artists are represented, but they didn't go about it from an art historical perspective except in one important way, and that is they collected deeply within a single artist's body of work, and they collected across media. So when you see the third floor installation of Alberto Giacometti, you will see painting, prints, drawings, and sculpture, as well as jewelry, splendid, spectacular piece of jewelry, and then other decorative artworks that he probably had an influence on, and they were done by his brother Diego.
So what is in the museum is about 1,500 pieces, and that's only a portion of the collection that the Bettors
right
collected. Do you know how many pieces of art they had at their peak?
Well, I guess it depends on how you define the family. But if you're talking about Hans and Bessie, for mm-hmm. example, it was, let's just say, 3,000 plus.
Because these are not just paintings that you would hang over the sofa. Some of these are enormous paintings. Some of them are tiny little works of jewelry and medallions. Others are big pieces of avant-garde sculpture. Then, of course, there's the Firebird, which mm-hmm. is enormous. Where did they put them? How did they display them when they didn't have them in a museum?
Well, some of the larger pieces actually came later as a result of Andreas's collecting. And in the instance of the Firebird, you should know he acquired that specifically for the museum. From the very beginning, he knew that he needed to have some kind of important artistic statement outside of the museum. And he thought of Nicky, who was a friend of his, and originally he was thinking of having a fountain sculpture, not unlike the Nicky de Saint-Phalle and Jean Tanguy work that you see outside of the Pompidou Center in Paris, mm-hmm. France's great modern art museum. So he was thinking in that regard. But the family didn't live with everything up on their walls in Zurich. In fact, they displayed many things at the various workplaces of their company. And they did that on purpose. Originally, it was just, you know, kind of predictably and not inappropriately to appoint the executive offices, and they were acquiring so much they needed to put it someplace. But ultimately, they came to realize that as the works began to sort of travel throughout all of the buildings, into the cafeterias and down all of the public areas, that they began to sense the effect that those works had on their employees. They began to achieve a higher sense of awareness of the beneficial aspect of their patronage on a larger audience. And that, too, is one of the themes that was not lost on Andreas at all.
A lot of people have difficulty with modern art because it is not, what's the word I'm looking for, a presentational representation? It's not
Norman Rockwell.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So how should people approach this? Because some things are very odd in this collection. If you come from it from a point of view of a typical landscape or portrait that you would look at
sure.
in a museum.
By the way, I love Norman Rockwell, especially the social and historical and political work. And it's not as though there isn't some representational art in the collection. There is, but you're right. The vast majority of it is purely modern in the sense that modernism is defined by various inquiries into abstraction, non-representative art. I guess I would just say a couple of things. First of all, great art, whether it's music or poetry or literature or filmmaking and visual art, its first job is not necessarily to make us feel comfortable or to be easy. Great art, generally speaking, challenges us in one way or the other, pushes us to think more deeply, more insightfully about what constitutes the very nature of art and what is this artist trying to say and what do I think I am hearing. Because that engagement, I mean, between the viewer and the artwork, this is a two-way street, no matter what we think. I think in the end we all bring something to that experience, whether it's going to the symphony or to a good movie or whatever it's been. Therefore, it's important for all of us to remain open to all new kinds of art, or that is to say, kinds of art that are new to us, to take a chance, to pay attention to the experience that you're having when you're standing in front of that painting. And that's why it is worth investigating, waiting for that docent tour, coming to that program, reading the catalog, going online, looking at something else. This kind of effort, I think, is rewarded for the vast majority of people who are ready to open themselves up to that new experience, whether it's at the Beckler or the Gantt or with the Charlotte Symphony, whatever it ends up being. I think it's important for us each to find ways to stretch. You know, sometimes we do it at work, sometimes we do it in athletics, we do it with our relationships, we do it in a lot of different ways. That should also be done in the world of art as well.
Put your headphones on for a second because we have a question about the Firebird from Barry in Charlotte. Welcome to the program, Barry.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Morning.
Morning.
Mr. Boyer, I just have a question for you. I'm remembering hearing the mythologist and storyteller Michael Mead speak at one point, and I'm forgetting the specific cultural reference or the cultural origin of this myth, but there is a myth that speaks about when the hero or the heroine goes out on their journey, they are to go and seize the feather of the Firebird, and to bring that feather back is a very significant part of their initiation on this hero or heroine's journey. And I'm wondering if there's any significance that you are aware of with that piece of art. I was very struck by your question, Mike, about what a bold thing it was to put this particular sculpture, and I was thinking it was very bold, perhaps given some of the mythic significance of the Firebird.
Hmm. Well, it's hard to get too specific about various forms of established mythology as they may apply to any piece by Nicky. And you're right, whether it's Mead or whether it's Joseph Campbell or any other number of figures who have gone on to analyze the path of the hero and how they relate to these ancient forms like a firebird or in some instances it could be a phoenix. Or with Nicky, she had a very broad and deep awareness of myths from all kinds of cultures, and in the end, the works that we see by her are her own sort of fabulous reinvention and a conglomeration of all of these different elements so that it becomes truly her own unique mythology. This will be one of the things that we'll explore in the exhibition that we will be doing this next year so that we can put the Firebird and other works that we have in the collection into that larger context of Nicky's inquiry. But I think that's the other great thing about these pieces is that they encourage us to ask these kinds of questions, try to put the subject matter, to the degree we understand the subject matter of this particular sculpture, into that larger arena of established myth. But I don't think that we'll ever find a direct one-to-one on that one.
Sure. Well, I hope she won't mind. When I walk by that sculpture, I'm going to imagine seizing the golden feather.
Well, you know, I think she'd love it.
So many people are having their photographs taken in front of and underneath the branch there that they're kind of doing that. They're taking the photograph of the bird with them in it, and they're therefore taking that feather away with them when they go.
Well, certainly the wedding photographs they're taking that golden feather with them.
Yeah. Okay. Well, thank you very much.
You're welcome. Because I have a picture on my cell phone of the firebird.
I hope so.
I mean, it seems like you have to take a photograph of it.
Well, it's so compulsory these days, apparently, that you may have seen yesterday in the Observer that there's now a photography contest that people are encouraged to send in their best, their most, you know, infamous photograph of themselves.
What was the vision for the museum by Andreas Beckler when this was still just not even on the drawing boards, when they hadn't chosen an architect, when, in fact, I think it was not going to be downtown, it was going to be someplace else? What was the vision for the museum?
The original idea was to have the collection housed in, I guess, what you could refer to as a gallery space that was to have been built out on some property that Andreas has owned for some time, and where, I suppose now about 15 years ago, he built a series of artist studios where painters and sculptors and musicians and others have worked out there varying lengths of time in a very loose confederation of like-minded individuals, where they can develop their own artistic impulse in quiet when they want it, and with their colleagues when they have an appetite for it. And so out there on this beautiful piece of property was going to be built some kind of gallery space. And in fact, it was to build that structure that Andreas had gone to Mario Botta. And in fact, Mario had designed a wonderful building, dramatically different from the one that we have downtown now. Mario had designed something about the same size for, in effect, the same patron to house the same collection. And it was stunning. And they were about 2 months away from breaking ground. I mean, this is how much had been invested in that process.
Wow.
And all of that Andreas was ultimately ready to walk away from in order to, in order to make the collection available to an even larger audience that would include all of the artists and others whom he had hoped would take advantage of those wonderful pieces out there at the Artist Colony. Back when it was originally to be built in the Artist Colony, he'd hoped, too, that other collectors and other artists and other scholars and connoisseurs would come, and that periodically it would also be opened for specific tours for school groups and for others. And so, in fact, by building the museum on South Tryon, it becomes ultimately the best of all possible worlds, because you can welcome the full breadth of those audiences who have an interest in a great collection like ours.
I was going to ask you how Mario Botta was decided upon as the architect. So obviously Andreas made that decision.
He did, and this was back when it was, you know, fully a private venture, and Andreas had a handful of advisors who were very critical in this work. Mm-hmm. And they talked about having an international competition with maybe a major figure, but in the end, Andreas woke up one night and he felt it should be Mario Botta.
We'll talk more about him, Mario Botta, and when we come back. Our guest today is John Boyer, the president and CEO of the Beckler Museum of Modern Art on South Tryon Street. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. And Charlotte Talks is made possible in part today by Charlie's Soap, makers of hypoallergenic biodegradable laundry powder, liquid, and all-purpose cleaner, made in North Carolina. Available online at charliesoap.com. New UN Security Council sanctions on Iran over its nuclear program intensify tensions between Tehran and other nations. Iran's relationship with the world and its internal conflicts 1 year after disputed presidential elections. The topic of the Diane Rehm Show today at 10 o'clock in about 20 minutes. And if you'd like to join our conversation about the Beckler Museum of Art, now's the time. 704-926-WFAE. That's 704-926-9323. 800-603-WFAE. Or every other way possible, WFAE.org/Charlotte Talks. We're coming right back.
See monarchs, painted ladies, and other butterflies with WFAE on Saturday afternoon, June 26th from 1 to 4. We'll be at the Gautama Science Center in Hickory for the Flutterby exhibit. It features native and semi-tropical butterflies in an outdoor courtyard. More information about the Flutterby exhibit at the Gautama Science Center at WFAE.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the Beckman Museum of Modern Art with the president and CEO of the museum, John Boyer, our guest this hour. Let me read a Facebook comment from Lloyd, who says, "Yes!" Exclamation point. Victor Borge would say, was there at the ribbon cutting, have been back twice, and think the Beckler's audio tour is the best narrated museum tour ever. I thought it was daggone fine. I really did.
Thank you.
You have a future in this. If this doesn't work out, you have a future. The turkey sandwiches available in the lobby cafe are also outstanding. And by the way, that is a great kept secret. I happen to know the caterer who runs that, and she and her husband are just wonderful.
Oh, they are.
And that's a great bargain, that lunch over there.
Oh, it's huge. And I think, too, that, and of course, Leslie and Bruce are just fabulous
Schwarzenegger,
people. That's
yeah.
right. Porcupine Provisions, mm-hmm. and they worked long and hard to find just the right menu and just the right fit, and I'm telling you, you're right, I agree completely, the turkey sandwich is to die for. But in addition to being a great value and a very quick in and out, and everything is made for you when you ask for
right.
it, as opposed to prepackaged,
right.
I mean, that's the other thing, it's a big differentiator, I would argue. There you are seated with the Firebird to your right and the spectacular Saul LeWitt mural above you, and then the family portraits by Andy Warhol. That's pretty good company,
yeah.
I think, when you want to sit down for a quick lunch.
Not a visual interest. You can't take it all in even in the course of a sandwich. You have to really come back for another sandwich. And he continues on this Facebook comment. And the Mario Botta building, one of only two of his designs in all of America, that is also a work of art. Love the Beckler. The other building that Mario Botta designed, of course, is the San Francisco Museum of Modern Art. I went online yesterday just to take a look at it. Our building's better. It just doesn't look interesting.
I have no official comment at this time. But what I think what I would say is that each work represents a different point in
sure.
Mario's development as an artistic genius, and we got him a little bit later in the process, and I think that it's different.
Well, our building is just darned interesting. As it was going up, I thought, this is going to be really different. And then as the terracotta tiles got put on it and it began to take shape, you realized how stunningly visually interesting it is and how unlike anything else in this city it is, and yet it's part of the fabric of the whole.
Well, I think you've captured the most compelling point in that it is so profoundly different from anything else. It's profoundly different from anything else in the cultural campus. And yet that campus is a wonderful example of very smart leadership, frankly, by Bob Burgess and the Wachovia team as developers, being able to corral, in effect, five different architectural firms to produce designs that work together as seamlessly as they do and yet maintain their own autonomy and independence as artistic expressions. But you're right, Mario's building is quite unlike anything else you'll see here in Charlotte, but frankly, quite unlike anything that you're going to see in any other American city.
Mm-hmm. And the, I don't even know what to call it, the column, the terracotta column that's mm-hmm. kind of by itself and is itself, I think, a kind of work of art, supports the fourth floor gallery. Mm-hmm. It's the key support.
It is. I would just half imagine, and again, I wasn't there during the early stages of design, I'll bet you on that Mario would love to have found a way to have that cantilevered entirely without the column. But in the end, realizing that you would need the column, he was going to make it something spectacular and muscular and full of energy, which, of course, it is. And it's the perfect, I think, it's the perfect balancing act with the Firebird, mm-hmm. which, because it's all reflective and almost seems like it's, you know, sort of insubstantial in its mass, but just as filled with verve and energy as that column is. They work together beautifully.
And when you go in, the building is a work of art from the outside, but when you go in, it's also a work of art on the inside, mm-hmm. and it is obviously designed to be an art museum and not anything else, because when you're in, it's a donut. And when you're in one of the galleries, any one of the galleries, you can look through to the other gallery through the center of the donut. And strategically placed, obviously, you had to think mm-hmm. about this, are works of art that are enormous, but still are big enough, they're big enough to see from the other side of the donut.
Especially on that on the fourth floor, we've got the openings that you're referring to. From the far wall to the front wall, it's about half the length of a football field. And so you need some extraordinary visual terminus to mm-hmm. anchor that view. So at one end, we've got this huge work by Alexander Calder, and the other gigantic work by Fernand Léger. And yet they speak to each other so beautifully, all the way across from one end of the building to the other. You're right, but in the middle of that experience is a four-story tall open atrium filled with light that just has the most profound and beneficial effect on all of these gallery spaces. And so rather than going into a hermetically sealed box where you go from one cell of space to the next cell of space to the next, so many of these different areas are interconnected to each other visually, spatially, and that gives a wonderful sense of dynamism mm-hmm. when you're in these spaces. And I think that people don't get as exhausted, I'll allow this, I don't think people get as exhausted in their museum experience in a building like ours than they do in that normal, traditional form of building where you just go from one discrete room to the next discrete room and it's kind of endless and you don't know where you are after a while. My God, what part of the building am I in? Mm-hmm. You're always reminded of where you are in this fabulous museum by Mario.
I want to get back to the whole cultural campus and how this building fits into it. Was Mario Botta given parameters when he designed this building that it has to work in such a way that it has to fit in with the Knight Theater of which it is actually connected, and the Mint Museum, which is going up across the street, mm-hmm. and then the Afro-American Cultural Center, the Harvey Gantt Center, that's across the other street. Was he given parameters that this has to fit in some way?
The only parameter he was given, frankly, was the plot of land that could be dedicated to the museum. And you should know that the museum went through a couple of different design changes, even in terms of how it was oriented to the street. You have to imagine the way it's facing the street now. Imagine it making a hard right and facing the new tower that way instead. So they were toying with a lot of different placements. And in fact, originally, the first design for South Tryon was not physically connected necessarily to the Knight Theater. Mm-hmm. But of course, over time that happened. And as a result of that, and for many other reasons, we have remarkable design and construction efficiencies that make these buildings a very compelling return on investment. So we share a loading dock with the Knight Theater. We all share a 300-seat theater that Wells Fargo makes available to us.
Downstairs in the
beautiful, state-of-the-art theater. And we use that for our programming as well. Mm-hmm. And a gigantic chiller complex that supports the HVAC for the Mint, the Knight, and the Beckler. And these kinds of efficiencies help not only on the dollar side of construction, but ultimately on the dollar side of operating. So it's a very smart approach. And again, we have to give credit to Bob Burgess and that whole design team at the very beginning.
Had I not gone to a performance at the Knight Theater shortly before the opening of the Beckler on opening day, when you were letting everybody in for free, I would have thought that the lobby of the Knight was yours because people were, that's why you came in, because there were so many people who wanted to see this on opening day that they opened the Knight Theater lobby to accommodate the overflow and then opened the theater so that people really stood in the aisles of the theater, then went through the theater, past the lobby, and then into your lobby, and finally into your museum. How many people have seen the Beckler since you've opened the doors? Any idea?
Oh, sure. That first day alone, I will admit we lost count. I mean, we had no idea what to expect.
Did that surprise you?
Absolutely. We were shocked. I mean, I shouldn't admit it on air, but we were shocked. You hear all kinds of things about any community, and there were a lot of folks who were saying that, well, is Charlotte ready for a museum mm-hmm, that's principally mm-hmm. dedicated to mid-20th century European modernism? I mean, nobody could answer that question convincingly, and I understand that. So we just didn't know it was going to happen. That first day alone, we had more than 5,000. It was probably closer to 6,000 people, and the Knight, being such great partners for us as they are, Tom Gabbard and his entire team are just the best people to work with. They instantly opened up and accommodated that overflow, which was, as you suggest, quite remarkable. We've been very conservative in our estimates in terms of visitation, although we've already exceeded them, gratefully. We expect to receive about 40 to 50,000 people on average going forward, and this year we're on that pace. And I think for an institution with a focus like ours, those are very reasonable numbers, and we trust that over time, and there's always that first year bump, and you never know what year two is going to be like, which we all acknowledge. Over time, as the institution gets to be better known, as we develop even more partnerships with other institutions across the country and overseas in developing shared exhibitions, I can see those numbers going higher.
You know, I read one article that said, that bemoaned the fact that the opening of this museum did not get sufficient coverage in the national press and even in the national artistic press. And then I ended up reading an article in the New York Times about it that was very favorable, so it got some press. Are you getting what you think you deserve?
Well, you'll forgive me for saying with the media, I'm never quite sure what I deserve. But in terms of what we'd like, I think that we've been very happy. The Times piece was extraordinary because not only was it in the travel section, but it was, as it were, above the fold on their website for a couple of days over a long weekend, and huge number of hits. And I have to say, too, The Observer has done a wonderful job for the Beckler, as they've actually done for the other new cultural institutions and for NASCAR. And I think that they're to be applauded for dedicating so much space and energy to these new institutions and their births. We've been in a number of discipline-specific periodicals within the museum and in the art world, so we feel very good about all of that. But whether or not you get into Time or Newsweek anymore, although who
might be irrelevant.
I was going to say you'd love to be, mm-hmm. but I think in many other ways it may be more important to have a more vital viral and internet presence, which we do have.
But within the art world itself, where people talk, and they talk positively and negatively and sometimes sharply, what kind of reaction have you gotten? Do you know?
Reminds me of the old saw about, you know, why the political infighting in academia is so bitter. It's because the stakes are so small. So it's not that much different in the arts world. I would say, however, just a couple of quick anecdotal remarks. And by the way, you know, the periodical for the museum world, Museum, mm-hmm. which is published by the American Association of Museums, did highlight us when we opened. So, mm-hmm. I mean, right off the bat, editorially, they recognized the importance of our being launched. Suffice it to say, I was at a meeting with a colleague in Washington, D.C. about a month ago. And she told me, and she had no reason to flatter me, I don't think, she said that there is such a buzz about this museum, especially since it was in the New York Times, yeah. all up and down the Eastern Seaboard. That's the way that she described it, and she's based in Washington, D.C. And then I went to visit a couple of old colleagues of mine. We'd gone through graduate school at Princeton together, and they're both curators at the Met. And when I met them for lunch and we sat down, all they wanted to do was ask about our collection. So tell me more about the Jock Committee. So which Sandy Calder do you have? You know, tell me the Juan Miró story with Hans Beckler, et cetera, et cetera. So within the colleagues whom I know well and some that I've just recently met, there's a great deal of enthusiasm about the museum and the collection.
Well, there's a great deal of enthusiasm online about it because I'm looking at a bunch of emails and Facebook comments. And a comment from Twitter says, the Beckler is housed in a fabulous collection and the building rocks. I love the Beckler Museum, saw it in April. Email from Carla. I was a good friend of Michael Godfrey's for 18 years before he died in April. I was wondering if John could speak about what the museum has planned as to how to honor him at the Beckler, since Michael was such an integral part of this amazing gift to Charlotte from the beginning and was an incredible artist in his own right. For people who don't know, for 20 years, Michael Godfrey worked very closely with Andreas Beckler and was chosen to be the curator of this museum, and we were supposed to have him as a guest, and moments before he was going to be a guest, he quite suddenly and unexpectedly passed away. This was a major loss, it seems to me, to both to the city of Charlotte and to the Beckler and to Andreas. So talk about his impact on this collection, on this museum, and what you plan to do in the future about that.
Certainly. Let me answer the last question first. The Beckler, of course, should never presume to represent all the different organizations with whom Michael had an important relationship, and there were many. And this is his church and other groups where Michael was involved. And so a couple of very important advisors, I would argue the closest friends that Michael had, are overseas right now in Eastern Europe, and they'll be back in the beginning of July. And so we've promised to convene and talk about what would be the next best thing to do. And obviously been talking with Michael's sister, Cookie, mm-hmm. And with Andreas about that. So we're not sure what that's going to be, but in terms of an event, I would imagine more than likely we would do something in the fall. And it may, in fact, this is quite unofficial because there's an awful lot of discussion yet to come, but it may well be connected to the opening exhibition on the School of Paris that we'll be doing, because Michael had basically, I suppose you could say that he got that exhibition to about 85% of where it needed to be. And one of the last things that he and I had done together was that we looked at two different versions of that exhibition, where literally he pulled out all the pieces that he was recommending that should be shown and had them all spread out in our collection storage area. And we went through that twice, and it's an absolutely stunning exhibition. So I think we'll do something then. And then just to answer the question, really nobody knew the collection as well as Michael.
Right.
So he's completely irreplaceable. And this upcoming year, I will end up curating these first three shows. But on a parallel track, we'll be looking probably for a series of specialists to work with us on some focused exhibitions on different themes, different periods, movements, and artists. That's the current thinking. So, and the board and I are remaining open.
And the School of Paris was a movement which rose up after World War II, and that will be the focus of the next big change in the museum in terms of its exhibits in September. Very quickly, Kathy writes on our website a comment to add to Mike's question, my question about art being different than what many people are accustomed to seeing. I have found that for both myself and my children, viewing art from a broad spectrum has been highly valuable for us all. Sometimes you go to see what you know you will love, but it is just as valuable to see that it is what is new to you, and likely it will take you out of your comfort zone. It gives me the opportunity to find new joy in art. If one does not like what one sees, it helps us to find even more what we do like about the art that gives us joy. Either instance is a wonderful experience.
Amen.
We'll end it there then. thank you for taking the hour. John Boyer is the president and CEO of the Beckler Museum of Art on South Tryon Street. Go see it.
Thank you so much.
Welcome.
Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of